It's very difficult to keep the line between the past and the present. Here in America, where celebrity culture has never reared its ugly head more than when the Kennedys are involved, it was probably an automatic yes from the Maisels brothers, Albert and David, when they were approached by Lee Radziwill in 1972 to make a documentary about her childhood in East Hampton, New York. Lee's sister was Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis, one of the most famous women in the world. Lee was a socialite in her own right, spending her fashionable days in New York City with Truman Capote and Andy Warhol. She met the Maisels through her friend Bianca Jagger, as they had just finished work on Gimme Shelter, a Rolling Stones documentary that included a controversial scene with the murder of a concert patron at Altamont, filmed in their developing style of direct cinema. Lee pitched her idea to the Maisels and introduced them to her aunt, Edith Ewing Bouvier Beale, and her cousin, Edith Bouvier Beale. They were known as Big Edie and Little Edie. The brothers soon realized that these two women were the true stars. They parted ways with Lee and returned to film with Big and Little Edie the following year at their crumbling mansion in East Hampton, Grey Gardens. Right before the Maisels had met them, Lee and Jackie had paid to clean up and restore Grey Gardens. Big and Little Edie had become national news after being threatened with eviction by the village of East Hampton for the state of the house. The once beautiful mansion was now flea-infested, overrun by cats and raccoons, and filled with trash and excrement. The Kennedy connection propelled them into the limelight. Providing an unflinching look at the two fading socialites turned recluses, we saw Big Edie and Little Edie bicker and commiserate, sing songs and remember their former glories, and give us the textbook definition of codependent relationship. David and Albert are always there, the audience for these two performers, giving them the attention they had missed for all the years they had hidden themselves away. Making its debut with the New York Film Festival on September 27, 1975, Grey Gardens would go on to cause controversy, obtain cult status, and become a feminist and queer community touchstone. It's constantly in the conversation of best documentaries ever made, making appearances in the Sight and Sound poll, and also named the number one best documentary of all time in the PBS public poll. Little Edie tells us that it's very difficult to keep the line between the past and the present, and for 95 charming, funny, and at times excruciating minutes, we see exactly what she means. She tells us she's a staunch character, and that there's nothing worse than dealing with a staunch woman. And if you see yourself in her, it's a kinship you will never forget. I'm Violet Hammond, and this is Movieversaries. Welcome to Movieversaries. I'm your host, Violet Hammond, and this is where we celebrate and sometimes reevaluate some of the greatest movies ever on a significant anniversary. On this episode, we're discussing Grey Gardens, one of the most famous documentaries ever made, on its 50th anniversary. And here with me today is a fellow staunch character. It's the co-host of Chucky Vision and the host of At the Movies in the Naughties and a newcomer to Movieversaries. Please welcome Dev Elson.
Hello, everyone. You got that right in there, right at the start. Staunch.
Staunch characters. Staunch characters only here.
Oh, that's wonderful. Thank you for that.
You're very welcome. Just slight peek behind the curtain, but we talked about Royal Tenenbaums on your podcast At the Movies in the Naughties, and in that discussion, it was discussed how Wes Anderson was influenced by Grey Gardens and the Maisels brothers, and how that became like the Rosetta Stone for me of seeing Royal Tenenbaums in an entirely new way. So when I was going through my solo episodes for Movieversaries this year and realized it was the 50th anniversary of Grey Gardens, one thing I really wanted to do was get you on the show so we could talk Grey Gardens, and I'm so happy it happened.
Oh, thank you for doing that research, because I didn't re-listen to the episode. And one of my opening thoughts was, who brought this up? How did this come about?
And that's absolutely why I said, oh, I'm like, I want to talk about Grey Gardens, and I really wanted to talk about it with you. So thank you for making the time and being here today.
Oh, I'm very happy to be here. Yeah, it's a great podcast, and this is a good movie.
Yes, it is a lot of fun, and I'm so ready to get into it. So here on Movieversaries, the first question we love to ask our guests is, what does this film mean to you?
That is a great first question for this movie, especially after your incredibly well-written and well-researched opening about this movie.
Because, thank you.
Well, I mean, yeah, that's an honest compliment, and also it counters what my answer to this was, which is I know most guests on these movie podcasts, they bring the movie, but this was a case where you invited me on for this. I'll put it out there, you know, for all that detail you just gave, I had seen this movie. I wasn't lying about that. I'd seen it in the past, and I rewatched it for this podcast. But for all that backstory you gave, when I watched this movie just the other week, I loved it. I really loved it. And I know that you have a connection to New York, because we talked about that on our podcast. But yes. I don't. So I didn't know who these people were. I didn't really know what the Grey Gardens was. I mean, I know what it is, but, like, I don't know the significance of it. I know East Hampton as a name, but, like, you know, I've never been there. So,
yeah.
In terms of what this film means to me, I have zero frame of reference for it. But as a documentary, you know, it highlights something real that happened in the world. And I think it does such a great job at that, that I still have plenty to talk about it with this movie. I think it is, as a documentary, a wonderful window into the past, in a slice of life. And I think, we're getting into it already, what is remarkable about this movie, as you said, with direct cinema, is that so much of that context, so much of that information that you gave, how much of that is in this movie? Not a lot.
Yeah. No, so, it really isn't.
Yeah, so when I finished the movie, I still didn't have a lot of answers to what it was about. But I got what it was about, because it's crucially about these two people. And I felt like I knew them after.
Yes, you definitely do know them. I think that it really is so amazing that it starts out with all those newspaper clippings. So you see the newspaper clippings at the top of the movie of, as Little Edie referred to it, the raids of Suffolk County Health Department coming into the house, the eviction notices, and the fact that they're more famous, more wealthy relatives at that point came and basically bailed them out so they could keep the house. So you have that at the top of the movie, but it really truly is about Big and Little Edie. It doesn't come, they don't bring up Jackie constantly, and Jackie is what really pushed it into national news and what everyone was so obsessed with. How did these two women fall from grace like this? And what I think is so fascinating in the movie, and probably fascinated people at the time and continues to fascinate us 50 years later, is how they are just living their life the way they choose to. It's their choice. Everything in the movie is like their choice, their agency, and they really don't care what anybody else thinks. And they're not ashamed of it. And they're doing things that you would think you would be ashamed of. And that's why it's so like unflinching, and why people have a hard time looking at it. Because we're not used to doing that. We're always performing for people. And they're not. They're just doing whatever they feel like. And what they feel like is, you know, Little Edie throwing Wonder Bread on the floor for raccoons. Like, it's insane. You know, it's crazy, but there's this weird freedom in it. And then we'll go back and we're going to talk about it in a little bit, probably when we get to the themes of it. But, I mean, Little Edie is the star of this movie.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
She's living her life in this way, but all she talks about for 90 minutes is how she wants to get the hell out of
here. Which, again, is a great... That's a great element of the documentary and the power it has in the way it's directed, because you can look up the Wikipedia and you can find out exactly how long she was there. But if you're just watching this movie, it does feel like she's been there for 100 years.
Yes. They're like, you see them in the beginning and this is the house after it was already cleaned up.
Yeah. If you miss that information in that opening with all the newspapers, like, I was watching this like half in mind thinking, so like, are they gonna clean it up? Like, where's this deadline coming? And then I was like, oh wait, that already happened.
That already happened. What you see in this movie, and it is still so messy, like it is, and she's literally climbing the stairs to the attic and throwing bread on the floor for breakfast. Like, that is the state of this house, and it's just normal. It's like, this is my life. This is what I do. The cats are everywhere. They do their business everywhere. And this is after it's already been cleaned up.
And what it,
it's insanity.
And what is strange about the documentaries, even though the directors are in the movie, they are essentially characters in the story. Like, it still feels so undirected at times. Like, or the direction is so subtle. Like, there were moments where I was questioning about it. Like, sometimes you would see the mess, it would highlight the mess, but then there would be long stretches of time where we're just focusing on the women and just listening to their stories, and you'd kind of forget really how much of a tip this place is, because it's not constantly pointing and poking at that aspect. It's introduced as the context why they went there, but the documentary isn't really about that.
No It really isn't. And it's just about this choice and, again, the codependency of when we get into their pasts and you see those gorgeous pictures of them and how beautiful these women were and how they had this socialite life. And then how for Big Edie, it all started to fall apart when her husband cabled her from Mexico that he had found someone else, and like, that was it. And she just started to just hide at this summer house. This was their summer house. She just was hiding in there, and little Edie was off living her life and trying to be an actress and a model in New York City. And she just needed her back with her. And she went because she loved her mother, but she complains about it for 90 minutes. She wants to be anywhere else. But she also had, she had alopecia, stress-induced, and lost all of her hair, which is why she wears her iconic headscarves the whole time.
Again, another point in the documentary, another standard, more traditional documentary would, like, explain that? Nope, never mentioned in the film. Like, you only find that out if you're doing, like, a research on it afterwards.
Right. For all you know, she has hair under there.
Yeah.
And she has all those amazing moments where she is, and you're absolutely right, David and Albert are characters in this movie. Like, they're asking her about her clothes, and she goes through the whole amazing description of her clothes and how it's really like a cape that she has pinned together with her fishnet stockings and her... At one point, she just has, like, a regular bath towel on her head with a brooch. And it's just... They treat her like a fashion icon. And she became a fashion icon. Like, famous fashion houses have done Little Edie collections. Because this is just the way she was just putting things on her body inside her madhouse. But she's so proud of it. And it's just the thing that's keeping her busy as she's stuck in this house all day with, like, 50 cats and 6 raccoons. Like, it is so insane to watch, but it's fascinating. You can't look away from it.
Yeah, you do have to question in instances like that one whether it's that is her authentic self or it's a case of like fake it till you make it and she made it. But I don't think like that distinction is even like important to figure out. I do believe watching this that who she is on camera is who she is off camera. You get this sense that she's performing definitely more than her mother. Like, she's checked out most of the time.
Yes, she is.
Whereas Little Edie, crucially, at certain points in the film, like, is acknowledging, you know, the camera and the presence. But still, like, yeah, it's, yeah, again, the documentary angle of, like, yeah, them telling all these stories. A traditional documentary would back that up with evidence, like, oh yeah, this was the past and this is what she's talking about. So many of these trips into the past are just in the middle of, like, arguments between them.
Yes.
And so, crucially, yes, you just have to take on faith that they are telling the truth. And it's rose-tinted glasses, but for the most part, what they're talking about is based in truth.
Yes, it is. They, like, Big Edie gets confused sometimes. She'll sometimes use the wrong people's names when she's telling stories from the past, but it is all still kind of the past or what she understands of it. It is true. So when you do start to get into the actual weeds of the research of it, it's, oh, okay, so they really were telling the truth. It's just, this was just how they dealt with their life. They hid in this house and it all fell down around them. And it is fascinating. It's just a fascinating view of, like we talked about on the Royal Tenenbaums episode, these people had everything, and then it all just crumbled around them, and they let it happen.
Yeah, that definitely is an aspect. And as you said, you know, Jackie O is in this, and that aspect isn't, like, a big part of this, but I think that is another kind of quieter aspect to this, which is fascinating. What draws people in is that you look at America, or you look at any country, and you look at, you know, you see these two people and you assume that, you know, this is the poor life, this is how poor people live, and it's an enticing notion that these people were rich and they came from, you know, they are still attached to wealthy families and, you know, that the high life. And the idea that this can happen to anyone, and the idea that this can just happen is, yeah, it's a really fascinating look at something. I mean, yeah, I mean, it's incredible, really, that it is all real.
Yes.
the Maisels just found such a fascinating, real, you know, they discovered this window into such a fascinating world, and it's crazy that we, you know, it's still so good.
Yeah, that leads us directly into, I mean, a question that it almost seems silly to ask, considering how we're talking about this movie. Does it still hold up? I mean, duh. I mean, you just watched it and it is still fascinating. It is a fascinating look at these women.
Yeah, yeah, hold up is a really good question for this. If you're talking about how you define that, you know, the relevancy is really what you make of it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, on a surface level, I think if you go into it just wanting a story, what is the documentary about? I think it does achieve that goal, that you are endeared to these two people by the end of it. I think that is definitely checked off. But the question kind of remains, why did I need to get to know these two people? And that pursuit is really why the documentary itself can hold up, because it was a pioneer of the direct cinema style. You know, a normal documentary would try and cram all of that historical context into the film and really give us, you know, hammer us over the head, like, this is why it's important, whereas this just lets us in. And I think in that aspect, it's really relevant to today's world in a big way, because you can see these similarities between Lil Edie embracing the limelight of being on camera with, like, modern sensibilities of, like, constant social media.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. She is, you know, like, the original influencer. And
yeah,
it's such a different concept, because it's like, oh, she, you know, the camera's on her, she's going to be a movie star. And it's so different from, like, being, like, a content creator these days. But she kind of had that mindset. She had that grind, you know. She was always performing, and, like, it worked out for her. And it's a little different because these days, you know, content creators, you know, they're glued to the camera. They are staring at you. They're always trying to make that connection. Edith never really addresses the camera in this movie, does she?
No.
Because this style is so like, pioneering. It's still so early. She's never talking to the camera. She's never talking to the audience. It's all just a very natural conversation with the Maisels. Yes. She's, you know, singing David's praises at one moment. You know, she talks of having David and Al in the house as company. And why it's such a fascinating journey with little Edie, because if you're really paying attention, like seeing it in a certain way, it's like a journey of this direct cinema really blossoming and blooming and showing how like special this style can be, because it's not just, even though she is talking to David and Al and she is talking about David and Al, like she is unconsciously like, this camera is an escape for her in this house. She keeps saying, like, oh, she's never going to leave this house. She's never going to get out. And in a way, she is getting out. It's like she knows she's going to be in all these cinemas and she's going to be on all these TVs, like, across space and time. You know, we're watching this documentary and we're experiencing her. And she is, like, kind of intrinsically understands the magic of this, that she is going to be larger than life. It because of this.
Oh, like that was beautiful. That was so perfect. And it is so true. On such a meta way, she was so happy to be in this movie because she knew she was really like a star. Like she was gonna live forever because of what David and Albert were doing. And like you can really hear it in her voice sometimes. Like she is so happy to be doing what she's doing.
And it's different from a lot of like, you know, modern social, you know, content creators and stuff. Like they might have that same desperation to be known, to be famous, but so much of it now is a grind. It's like it's treated as work, you know, making Instagram videos, like, you know, even doing podcasts. It's work. Whereas this never feels like she has to do it. It never feels like work. This is like just the whole thing is like a holiday to her. It's a vacation. It's like an escape. It's you know, as you said, she truly savors and enjoys every moment of this.
Yes. I mean, especially when you get to the point where she's choreographed her little flag dance and she's gonna perform for them, and how that's such an iconic image. Like even when they did the HBO movie with Drew Barrymore as little Edie, that's the opening scene of the movie. Is a recreation of her little flag dance with her white heels and her, oh my God. Like there's so many moments in this movie where it starts and you're like, here it is. Here's the iconic moment. Oh no, wait, 5 minutes down the line, here's another iconic moment. Like it's just packed. It's jam full of all of these, the things that sometimes for some people, you might not know this is what it's from because you might have seen gifs of it or something on the internet, and then you watch the Grey Gardens and you're like, oh, here's, I know like half this movie just from the internet.
Just the concept of making gifs of that's what I'm talking about. Yeah. Like the timelessness of it. Little Edie had no idea when she did that dance that people would be making gifs of it.
Yeah.
It seems so completely alien.
It seems crazy, but oh, here we are. We've hit a couple of different talking points, and we're going to get into some of it more as we go. And this is just fantastic. As far as themes of Grey Gardens, what are your thoughts on the themes of this film?
That is the million-dollar question. I have in my notes, it's like asking, what's the point? But like, I think themes are definitely different. You can have like themes without a point, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
There's definitely themes. There are certainly, by the time you finish this, there are themes and ideas and concepts that like you feel by the end of it, which is, you know, it's tricky because there's no strict narrative, as we've said. There's only certain plot points, moments, you know, like the dance, that kind of feel, you know, it built up to that, and then that's a moment.
Yes.
And that is, you know, really tricky craft within documentary, you know, directing. I mean, definitely, yeah, the themes are like the time, you know, the time and existence, if you know what I mean. Like, we are looking back at this for the podcast. We're looking back at the past, and we are really considering this as the past. And a big part of the documentary is that it doesn't traditionally edit in, you know, pictures and stories and stuff of the past. So much of that context is the Ediths showing us photos and showing us portraits and stuff from their past and telling us their past that way. And so we are looking back at this documentary as the past, and then in the documentary they are looking back at the past as well. So much of it is about the past and the present, and like just coming to grips with that, like, because Lil Edie seems so at peace at times with herself, where she is in the moment, and then at times, like, there's a real pining for the past, and certainly there's many moments in those talks where Big Edie is like, well, that was the past, and it turned out like this, didn't it? Like, she, you know, she wants the best for her daughter, but she definitely talks about missed opportunities a lot.
Oh, she does. She does. She brings up multiple times all of the marriage proposals that Little Edie turned down. That's a big thing that she's constantly bringing up.
Yeah, there's that incredible burn where she says, France fell, but Edie didn't.
Oh my gosh. But that's the thing. It's like, it's so, they're so mean to each other, but in a loving way. And it doesn't make any sense if you haven't seen this movie. But that's exactly like what it is. Like, they are bickering with love, but it is complete. So, like, I keep saying the word insane, but it is. It's just like watching it, you can't look away from it because you can't believe that they're saying these things to each other. And they're really all they have. These two women, they have each other, and that's really kind of, they have each other and this house. And the house is a character just as much as Little Edie and Big Edie.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. The sparseness of it and the isolation of it, again, becomes kind of the other contrasting or parallel theme of that they are talking about the past, and they are, you know, very keenly aware of time, but at the same time, the way we observe them in this documentary and the style, it feels so timeless. Like I said, it feels like they've been here forever. Yes. It's like they are ghosts in this house.
Yes.
And just the way it plays out, you know, so many long scenes are them just talking, and they spiral into these arguments, and you get the feeling just sitting there as an observer in these arguments, like, this feels like it's going on forever. Mm-hmm. And then you just get the impression that this is every day.
Yeah, it's just that now there's a camera on them. But that's also the amazing part of this documentary, is that in a way, as you said, like, Little Edie is performing kind of in a way, but it's more of, she's just happy to have attention. She wants the attention. Big Edie wants the attention sometimes too, but she is checked out a little bit. But you do get the feeling that this is what they're like, whether a camera is running or not.
Oh, like, yeah. Oh,
they're so authentic. For its 50th anniversary, there was an article in Salon by a writer named Andy Zeisler, and she mentioned how this movie is kind of like a Rorschach test. Like, every person that you talk to will probably tell you something different about what the theme of this movie is or what this movie is like. Mm. And that feels really real to me. And she also brings up the point of how, having seen it when she was in her 20s, and how now, how different it feels when you view it when you're older. And that really resonated with me, because I remember seeing this when I was maybe first or second year of high school. This was one of those movies that when I was, you know, a drama kid, joining the drama club when I got into high school, and then I finally, for the first time, had like older friends. So now I had older friends who were like juniors and seniors, and they were going to show me all the like kind of sacred texts of being a theater kid, read a queer kid. So they showed me Grey Gardens. They showed me Rocky Horror Picture Show. Like, they showed me these movies that became like the basis of, these are the movies that me and my friends love. We're going to base our whole personality on them. And when you see this as a teenager, like, Little Edie is just this larger than life presence that you think, like, I mean, she's like a Halloween costume. Like, you just are thinking, this is who I want to be. This is so cool. Look at how she's just living her life. And then the older you get when you return to this movie, you start looking at it more from Big Edie's perspective and the way Big Edie is talking and the relationship between the two of them. And it does, it changes as you get older and you look at it, you start picking out different things in it and it becomes sadder, but it also becomes more hopeful. It is just it's a ridiculously brilliant movie. It really is.
No, I totally get that aspect of it being a Rorschach test. I definitely feel like if you pay attention to watching it and if you let it, if you marinate in the themes and the relationship between these two, they are both talking points, and I think you can definitely agree with both of them in, I think, many people's lives, you know, because, yeah, little Edie is so authentic. She's so herself. And everyone wants that. Everyone wants that for themselves. They want to be so confident in who they are. But at the same time, you know, they are in this house. Yes. And you do have to agree with Big Edie at times. I mean, I think everyone has asked that of themselves. They've looked back on missed opportunities and what could have been, how their lives could have been better. In the same aspect, a lot of the time, we can be like little Edie. Like, she doesn't want to really dwell on that because you can't really dwell on missed opportunities like that. They are the past. You can't change the past. That happened. And so, yeah, depending on when you watch it in your life, that can be quite impactful to have that confrontation. I think the injection of the documentary, of the cameras being in this house at this time, I think it's like, you know, it's like putting a clock in this house, because it doesn't seem like they're aware of like what time or year or, you know, the idea of time moving outside in the world. And I think there's so many moments where little Edie is asking, you know, at the time, at times hypothetically, like, when am I getting out of here?
Mm-hmm.
But there is an earnestness to those questions. Like, she is asking the camera, she is asking them, like, when am I getting out of here? I think those cameras being there in that moment is like a kind of a wake-up call. You know, it's like, oh God, like, how long is this going to go on for? And yeah. I think in that aspect, that is, maybe that is the theme or the point of this, why the Maisels went there. Because, yeah, anybody and everybody can watch this film and kind of have that same wake-up call of, oh, you know, I'm not living in Grey Gardens, but maybe I'm living out the same arguments and conversations, and, you know, I'm metaphorically feeding the raccoons. Maybe I need to, you know, make some changes.
Oh, perfect. Love it. That was amazing. That's it. That's exactly it. Oh, I feel like this next talking point is going to be my favorite part of this conversation because there's just so much to say. What influence did this film have on culture and its medium? Like, girl, how much time do you have? Because this film is constantly referenced, like, to this day. I mean, the first thing that popped into my head when I was like, all right, well, we're going to talk about this is, like, let's talk about Jinx Monsoon being little Edie for Snatch Game on Drag Race and winning it because of the perfection of that little Edie impression. Like, it is, you can't escape the constant references to Grey Gardens. There's so many. It is all over our culture. They talk about it all the time. Was this one of those things for you where when you saw Grey Gardens, you were like, oh, so I've seen that joke in, like, you know, the Family Guy or any other show that you might have watched that made a Big Edie or Little Edie joke? Like, had you put those together when you saw Grey Gardens?
I'm trying to think. I'm sure I've seen some more esoteric references, kind of like Royal Tenenbaums. You know, how that is, you know, kind of a reference.
Yes.
I'm trying to remember when was the first time I saw this. It was ages ago. It must have been, like, in uni or something, you know, for a reason. So it had been ages ago. So I can't recall if I'd seen stuff before seeing it for the first time. But I definitely Oh, Jennifer, when I watched The Reference, I must have been somewhat aware of it. You know, I knew what it was. But definitely, when I rewatched it, when I rewatched Grey Gardens for this, I also rewatched the documentary Now episode.
Yes, which is brilliant.
Yeah, that is a loving tribute to this.
Oh, it really is. It is. It's just so pitch perfect. I love the documentary Now. It's so funny. It's made with love for sure. And it's funny to bring up Royal Tenenbaums again, because when I'm looking at this and you're looking at the release poster for Grey Gardens, which is little Edie in her fur coat in front of Grey Gardens in what's obviously the winter. And doesn't it look like Margot's coat?
Yeah, I can see that. I can definitely picture that. Yeah. Wow.
All of a sudden I was like, yeah, I'm like, there she is. Little Edie was rearing her head right there in Royal Tenenbaums. Yeah. It's, I mean, and we already mentioned like the GIFs and the memes. Like, I, you know, this is one of those movies that if you haven't seen it, when you do see it, you're like, oh, that's what that was from.
Yeah, in a really broad sense. Yeah, I mean, that documentary Now is a great example. And it makes sense why they would love this documentary and why probably a lot of comedians would love this documentary. Not that this film is making fun of these people. Obviously, it loves its subjects.
Yes.
I think that goes the same for a lot of comedians. So many moments in this documentary are so funny, so charming, so endearing. And it's like, oh man, I'm like, if only like I could write that well, if only I could write moments and character beats like that, which feel as natural and as iconic as stuff in this. And I feel like that is, you know, inspirational for a lot of stuff. Like, the, you know, the sitcom, the situational comedy, I wouldn't say Friends is like this. I wouldn't say Seinfeld is like this. But I know that Arrested Development was inspired by Royal Tenenbaums, which was in turn inspired by us. And I feel like sitcoms like that, where it's like, here is, you know, the same idea. Here is a quote-unquote crazy family, and they are all trapped in a house together. It is a real inspiration, this documentary is, because it was relatable, you know. They are focusing on these two random people, and they are highlighting this real moment in time and history. And I think it is relatable to a sense of, like, you know, families live together and they put up with each other's eccentricities. And that is a prime source of comedy, really.
Yeah. And it is. Like, this movie is very funny. Like, it you laugh a lot. There's times where I really, every time, will laugh out loud at things that little Edie says. But then you do get those quiet and heartbreaking moments. It mixes it all so well. It's just, it's very true to life.
Yeah. It's true to life in the sense that, like, I guess in a way, I suppose, you know, you are laughing at them because they're not always intentionally making jokes. But I feel like Little Edie, especially, you know, she's mm-hmm. like a natural born entertainer. I don't think she certainly does love this movie, so she didn't mind people, you know, laughing along with it and having a great time. You know, she showed it a lot, didn't mm-hmm. she, afterwards? So she definitely understands it. But it's like, you know, I'm just thinking of moments like something that really made me laugh is when she is quoting the poetry of Robert Frost, and she makes like a real point to be like, that's all you need. That's all you need to say. And then she just starts repeating the entire thing.
She says it over and over.
And her mother is just like so annoyed by it. And it's like, you get, like, you know, that, you know, brevity is wit, and then you just repeat it over and over again.
And you just keep going. Like, at least half of Big Edie's dialogue in this movie is, Edie, you're making me crazy, stop it. Like, everything is just, stop it, stop it, stop it. And then she just ignores her and keeps on going. It's so good. It's so funny.
Yeah.
And then she says stuff, like, to go back to your point of, like, the time, how you're not sure about the time. I feel like little Edie might not know what time of day it is. She's just doing everything by seasons, and she talks so often about winter, about how not wanting to go back to winter, being in this house in the winter is just the worst, and it's a summer house, so I can't even imagine how cold it must have been, because usually summer houses aren't really fortified for the cold the way that their house in New York City would have been. She mentions winter constantly, and that's the big number in the Grey Gardens musical, the Broadway musical that came in about somewhere, I think the late 2000s, of the documentary. One of Edie's last songs is called Another Winter in a Summer Town, and it's heartbreaking because she really is just like stuck in the cold.
Yeah, it certainly doesn't help when there's literal holes in the walls.
Oh my god, the holes that the raccoons are climbing through.
Again, it doesn't really highlight that until like way later when it's just like, oh, here's some raccoons crawling around. And it's like, wow, these walls are just like, it can't be well insulated, this house, at all.
This is my favorite question when we do movieversaries, because we've made a little bit of a joke about it. So the question is, what makes it great? But we like to say capital G great. Is this movie capital G great?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, we've said all the reasons why it's capital G great, but it is iconic and it is so influential, carrying on from the last question. It's, yeah, I mean, you watch it and you're so inspired for like a myriad of different reasons. You know, you're inspired by the people, you're inspired by how the documentary is directed to, you know, just highlight people's lives. It's just, you know, the point of the documentary, which is, you know, highlighting this point in their lives, is so capital G great. Yeah, there's so many reasons why this is great and this is important. Capital I important.
Yes, capital I important. I agree, obviously. I needed to talk about this movie because not only is it capital G great, it is one of my favorite movies, probably, of all time. And you find something new in it every time you watch it. So through, like, so many of our talking points here in terms of, you know, is it still relevant? Did it influence the culture? It did. It's so relevant. And it is capital G great. It's unbelievable.
And it's really rewatchable in a strange way.
Yes.
Because I think if you watch it for the first time, you might be taken aback by the style, and you might at moments be like, oh my god, these people are just arguing endlessly. Like, I feel like I'm losing my mind. But then by the end of it, it achieves its goal that you know, fall in love with these people. Like, you really do know them a bit better. And then that makes the rewatch is so comfy and so cozy, because like,
yes,
you know who these people are now, and you know what's going to happen, and so you can really savor and enjoy like each really funny moment. You know, like the first time you're probably just watching and, you know, taking in the dialogue and just taking in what the scene is about, and then like on rewatches you can be like, oh yeah, they're cooking corn on the cob like in bed.
Yes.
What is happening?
Yes, Jerry likes the way I do my corn. It's like, what? You're boiling corn on a hot plate in bed. Like, it's so good. It's one of those unquantifiable things where people say, why is it so good? I'm like, because it just is.
Yeah, I would have never compared it to Rocky Horror, because you mentioned that earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Grey Gardens and Rocky Horror, I would never see them in the same light. But they do have that same rewatchability, how, you know, Rocky Horror, when you go to screenings of that, the whole audience is cheering. The whole audience is,
yes,
yelling out lines. You know, the whole audience is in on it together. And you can,
yep,
kind of, you could get that with Grey Gardens. You know, everyone, when that scene comes on, everyone throws up corn on the cob. You know, everybody understands how crazy that imagery is, but they all love,
yep,
it.
But they love it. Everybody could be waving flags when Edie's doing,
yes,
her flag dance. Yeah. Oh, I would absolutely attend a midnight audience participation screening of Grey Gardens. I would come dressed up. I'd be so into it. Let's do it. Let's copyright it. Well, I know that you and I both love this film, but are there any shortcomings that you'd like to talk about?
Yeah, I've got some stuff here. Not to say I've got, you know, real shortcomings. It's a yes and no answer. Its greatest strength is the direct cinema approach. But if you are going into this like you go into other documentaries and you find that context enriches the experience, like you do want a story, then you don't necessarily get that in a conventional sense. Like I said, it can be completely missed that the house was quote-unquote renovated and quote-unquote,
mm-hmm,
cleaned. That opens up a question in itself. Like, what was the Hamptons' standards that this was up to code? Like, how bad was it before? And I guess going into that movie with that mindset, like, you might want to know that. You might want to actually know how bad it was before, which this film isn't interested in. And then, yeah, I mean, I kind of noted this. It's not, you can't really say this is a shortcoming of the documentary when it came out, but like the context afterwards, you know, the whole film builds up, you know, the whole film enforces this idea that Lily D is never getting out, that she is going to be trapped here forever. And then when you read the context, it's like, oh, okay, this and this happened like right after.
Yes.
But you can't really blame the film for that. I think that, so when I say yes and no, the shortcomings are that this isn't a conventional documentary, but what it is so good and so strong. Like I just said, the first time you go into it, it might not click immediately. You might not realize what it's doing, but if you allow yourself to embrace what it's doing, then any shortcomings slide away. They fall away. What the film is doing is incredible.
Yes. Absolutely. The only thing that I had under shortcomings, and the thing is that I don't even necessarily see it this way, but I feel like I should bring it up, is that the Maisels were accused of exploiting Big Edie and Little Edie, but they claimed that, and it's true, because Big Edie and Little Edie came out many times and said, we love this movie, we loved being a part of this movie, we were on board the whole time. But especially since they were paid for their time, they got $10,000, which at one point it was really frowned upon to pay documentary subjects. So that was part of it. And they were saying they took, you know, it was distasteful of them to take these two women who were most likely mentally ill and living this way and to put them on screen like this. And Albert Maisel said in 2014, their behavior was just their way of asserting themselves. And what could be a better way to assert themselves than a film about them asserting themselves? They were always in control.
Yeah.
So they address the controversy. I don't feel like it's very controversial. I never get the feeling when I'm watching it that they're being made to do anything. I think that it is, as we've mentioned multiple times, a very authentic view of these two women. But some people like to say, the detractors like to say, that it's an exploitive film. But I don't think I agree with that.
I think that is an argument that gets brought up, you know, more than once, depending on what the documentary subject is. I certainly feel like those quote-unquote controversies are historical in context. They were developing this style of direct cinema. And today, if anyone watches this movie now, we have such a range of documentaries, differing styles. But this was really kind of revolutionary for this style. Like, as you said, you know, they subjects weren't paid, and usually subjects were given questions. You know, it was very much like interview. Like an interview. It was question and answer. And that is what's fascinating about this documentary, is that they don't often really ask questions. They just turn the camera on and then let the subjects just be themselves. I know there is a follow-up to this, isn't there, with more footage, and that has more conversations, that has more interactions.
Yes.
Whereas this, the strength of this is that it is directed, and you can feel the presence of the Maisels behind the camera, even when, you know, sometimes they're on camera. But, yeah, it doesn't feel like they are directing them in any way. Yeah, it's you have to look at it at a certain point. You have to look at it with the historical lens of what it was doing at the time compared to all the stuff now. You know, when I was watching it, I always remember the Werner Herzog quote, when he talks about documentaries and how most documentaries are flies on the wall. And he says, no, we should be the hornets that sting. And he said that when he said that in like the 80s or something, that elicited a chorus of boos from traditional documentarians. So yeah, I feel like that is also just, that controversy goes with the territory in making documentaries. Like, you want to highlight these people without directing them, without interfering in that, you know, reality happening. And like you said, with some of those quotes and stuff, people get very defensive about that. Like, he's highlighting them, taking advantage of them. Because, I mean, that's, you know, the thing I think about before, like, with traditional, how documentaries were done before then, with the questions and answers, are the questions themselves not leading? You know, if this had the Maisels asking questions like, why do you live here? Like, why do you not clean up after yourself? You have to word those questions very, very objectively and very, very plainly as to not be leading, you know, like, because, like, I feel like at the time people may have watched this thinking like, oh, we're going to find out why these people live like this. We're going to find out why the house is the state it is. And that isn't really, none of that is really answered or even really exactly addressed. They just live like this. They just do. And I think that confused and even like agitated a lot of people at the time that they were almost like, why didn't you do something? Why didn't you do more? Like, you know, it's at the time, I think less so now, but at the time it was a very confrontational documentary.
Yes. Yes, I agree. And at that time of release, there was a lot of this blowback, but I don't think there's as much of it anymore. I think definitely the way critics view this has changed from when people felt, they must have felt like they were watching a car crash when this first came out. And now, like, over 50 years, you see all of the layers of it. And I think that people have softened on the whole they're exploiting them argument.
Oh, yeah. Nowadays, there's, like, entire channels and networks, dedicated to stuff like this. I mean, there's plenty of, like, you know, Hoarders, that was a show, right? And then, like, My 600 Pound Life.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so there's, like, all of those kind of were inspired by stuff like this. And those shows have the same controversies today. It's, like, highlighting them, is that bad or good?
Yeah. Is it exploitation? Yeah. And they all owe a debt to Grey Gardens, for sure. Do you have any favorite facts about Grey Gardens?
Well, that is an interesting thing. When you talked about a behind-the-scenes story or a production choice. Yeah, we've already touched on it a couple times. This film works by its own, achieves its goal, but it does kind of encourage you. It would have been difficult at the time, I guess, because I went down on a rabbit hole on this, but they didn't have Google back then. I wrote here, let it be on record, Violet never asked me to do this, but I do have a question for you. How much of the EGGM have you seen? The Extended Grey Gardens Multiverse?
You know, I actually have never seen Last Summer, which is the follow-up that you mentioned. And what it was is when the Maisels broke with Lee Radzwell and decided they just wanted to work with Little Edie and Big Edie, they surrendered all of the footage to her. So nobody really saw all that footage. So that's what they shot the summer before they were doing Grey Gardens. And I actually have never seen that, which is fault of mine. I should seek it out and try to see it because I do love Grey Gardens so much. I have seen the musical on Broadway and I produced the musical at my theater.
Ooh.
So, yeah. So I know that. I would include that as part of the extended universe.
I know it's part of it, yeah.
Yeah, so I have a lot of history with that. What's pretty crazy about that is when we were doing the musical, that was when Grey Gardens was being sold. So this is also my favorite fact about the film, so I'll fold it in here as we're having this discussion right now to answer your question. The house was purchased when Little Edie left, and that was because Big Edie passed away. And it wasn't that long after, it was only about 2 years after the movie.
Yeah, 77, yeah.
77, yeah.
That date in itself, though, is crazy. That's what I was referring to before, with the strength of this documentary, that it feels like they are going to be there forever. And then, no, you look at the history, and it's like, no, this changed. Like, their lives changed pretty much right after this documentary.
Right after it, yeah. It was purchased by the Washington Post editor, Ben Bradley, and his wife, Sally Quinn. They stayed there. What my favorite fact is that she sold the house to them, and they had to promise to restore it. They could not burn it down.
Mm.
So they restored the house and the grounds. And what little Edie famously told them was, it just needs a new coat of paint.
Just paint over the raccoon holes.
I love her so much. It just needs a new coat of paint. So that's what she told them. And they painstakingly restored the house. And they stayed there until Ben Bradley passed away. And then Sally Quinn found it too sad to stay in the house. And she sold the house. When I was doing the musical is when she put the house up for sale. And she actually had open houses open to the public. My little Edie, the actress who was playing little Edie in my production, went to one of the open houses and actually walked through Green Gardens. Yes.
Wow.
I forget what I was doing. I couldn't go. And I kick myself for it all the time because I don't know if I'll ever get the chance to do something like that again. But I'm so glad that she was able to go, and she took tons of pictures, and it was just, it's like sacred ground. You know? Mm. So that is something really special, that the house is still there, that now it's owned by Liz Lang, who's a fashion designer, and it is just a beautiful monument.
I've seen the pictures of the house as it was being bought and sold and renovated and stuff like that. Yeah, no, that would have been amazing to visit. You're right, yeah. It is sacred ground. But at the same time, it's also, when I was looking at those pictures, that you said before, the house feels like a character. It's so lived in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just the elements of, like, even the outside, you know, like the actual gardens are like a jungle. It's so impenetrable. And then when you look at the pictures as it exists now, like, all of that is gone.
Yeah.
And you can recognize the house, but it doesn't feel like the same house anymore.
No. No.
It's like, if you could visit it now, it wouldn't be the same. You wouldn't be stepping into the past like when you watch this film. You are just, you know, it's the house, but it's not the home.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Perfect way to put it. Yep. It's like 1930s Grey Gardens. It's not 1970s Grey Gardens. So let's get into favorites. This is always a fun part too. What's your favorite moment, line, scene, character? It can be anything, and it can be as many as you want.
Okay, everyone loves the dance.
Yes.
And I won't poo-poo anyone who says it's the dance, because it is incredible. It's such a great moment. And I feel like it is, like, built up. Like, there's somehow a narrative build up to that moment, and it feels really climactic when it happens.
Mm-hmm.
That is a really great moment. I personally really love the beach moment. Because that, again, that is set up in dialogue where little Edie really wants to go to the beach. And it's reinforced with all her talks of, like, oh, I'm never getting out of here. I just want to leave. And, you know, she talks about going to the beach as if it's some form of escape. And then she does. And it's such a simple setup and payoff. But you yourself watching it don't realize how suffocating this house is.
Yeah.
Until you see her on the beach. And it is like, you can feel the fresh air when she's there. Like, it feels like a real escape.
Yes, that's an amazing scene. It's an amazing scene. When you go through the quotes of this, it's just insane. Like, little Edie is constantly just giving you gems of dialogue. Like, no, I'm not ready, I have no makeup on, but things are getting better. Like, that's amazing. She's so amazing. Oh, here it is. He always compliments me on the way I do my corn.
No, I found myself doing that when I was making notes. Because so much of it is just dialogue and them talking. I was like, I cannot quote every other line because there are so many good ones.
Okay, when she walks out of the house and she says, God, if you knew how I felt, I'm ready to kill.
I love that energy. It's so great.
God, laugh out loud every single time, because it's like, yes, exactly. If you knew how I felt, I'm ready to kill. The way she looks, the way she says it, like, that's always in my most used gifts. Like, if I'm annoyed or something, or any small problem, I'm like, I'm ready to kill. Like, oh, little Edie, you icon. Like, I love her so much. But Yeah, and that is also the problem with this movie. We could sit here and go back and forth with dialogue forever. The part where she's, Big Edie's yelling at her because she wants her to find something, and she's like, I know where everything is. I can't find this thing. It's like so unintentionally funny, and just so, how they have just had it with each other, but they love each other so much. There's 90 minutes of brilliance.
Yeah, I mean, there are only a couple of quotes I have here are not really funny ones, but like, it does go to show, like, everything they're saying is so cinematic in a way. It's so literary. It's it feels so iconic, even though they're just saying it in the moment.
Yeah,
like there's a real crucial moment where we've talked about Big Edie kind of being checked out. You know, she is very much just a subject in this, and like not engaging with the camera much. But there is a moment where she says, you're wasting this thing on that just because it's nuts. Like, she is acknowledging, like, why are you making this?
Yes.
And that is just a really wild moment where she's like, I don't know why you're doing this.
Yes. Like, why are you here? Like, is this really worth your time? And I'm sure they were thinking, yeah, it really is. Oh, and then one more before we move on to MVP, but one more little Edie. Really, really soon, like close to the beginning of the movie, maybe one of the first times she greets the brothers outside, and she says, Mother wanted me to come out here in a kimono, so we had an awful fight. Like, you know from the jump, this is an icon. I love her so much. Well, I guess that kind of gives away. It's really difficult, but who is the MVP of Great Gardens?
It's not a huge selection because you listed like director, actor, DOP, etc. There are credits, you know, there are multiple people involved in getting this thing made other than just David and Al.
Yep.
I think if you're going to do like a tournament bracket, you face everyone against each other, it ultimately would come down to Edie versus Edie, wouldn't it?
Yes.
At the end of the day, it's one of them. Is it bigger or little Edie? And we made that point earlier that I think a lot of people, depending on where they are in their lives, it's very understandable that they would pick Big Edie. Mm-hmm. She has some very great moments in this.
She does.
But I think, as we were just saying, little Edie. She acknowledges the documentary and the form and just what she's doing and what they're doing in such a fascinating way. It's a constant effort to tell if she's acting and what level of acting it is. Is it, in I think the most relatable ways, the same level of acting that we all do, in a public persona? And whatever answer that is, at the end of the day, she's just so damn entertaining.
Yes. Yes, she is infinitely watchable. And yes, my MVP is also Little Edie. She is the star of Grey Gardens. And as I've said multiple times, I love her. I just love her. She's the best. And she did, after she sold the house, she was able, through the fame of this movie, to become a cabaret performer. So she did have a short career in showbiz, which is what she had wanted her whole life.
Yes, we should end this, saying that her life afterwards, yes, she did lose Big Edie shortly after, which is obviously sad. But I think, as sad as that is, it did give her the impetus to change. Like, she had to move out. Like, she couldn't live there alone. Yes. So it's very happy to know that she did move on and do, you know, nice things. Like, she seems to have achieved things after. I read that she would show Grey Gardens in gay clubs or a gay club and have audiences around, and they would all cheer, and she would do, you know, Q&As and just talk to the audience. So she, more than embraced it. She really got a second life out of this, which is really nice to her. It's nice to know that.
Absolutely. It has a happy ending. You might watch the movie and think, oh, at the end, but the knowledge of knowing that Little Edie did get a happily ever after makes it all so much better.
Yeah. I mean, that's, again, not a shortcoming because the film wouldn't have known, but like, the film is perfect.
Yeah.
But it does help to know that right after. Because if you were to never get curious and look it up, it is, I think we've said, both equally hopeful and sad, this movie. Yeah, the context certainly enriches it in a way. Not that it has to, but it does.
Yep, most definitely. Do you have anything else in your notes that you want to bring up before we wrap things up today?
I will double check. I've not got much. We never mentioned them, but I do love how people like Brooks and Jerry just come in and out randomly.
Yes.
Brooks has a job, but he somehow has to tackle that jungle outside their house. But then Jerry does bring them food, but then he just sort of wanders in and then just sits down and just hangs out of him.
He does. And then Edie, like, in a weird way, it felt, especially on this watch, it's almost kind of like sibling rivalry. Like, she gets jealous of the attention that Big Edie gives Jerry.
it's
strange.
It's very strange. And again, that goes back to what I was saying about the extended world of this, that he eventually got his own documentary.
Yes, he did. The Marble Fawn of Grey Gardens.
Because, he went on to be like, again, you watch this and you're like, oh, that's just some random, food delivery man. But no, he went on to be like an artist of some sort, didn't it? A sculptor or something.
He did. They found him driving a cab.
he was successful at a time. And then they found him driving a cab randomly. Like, that's such a random story to be attached to this. Everyone in this is so fascinating.
Yes, absolutely every person has some crazy thing that makes you latch onto them.
Because I think Brooks as well. Brooks did other houses, didn't he? He did, like, a bunch of houses in the Hamptons, I believe. So, like, he was working on very famous gardens as well as this one.
Yes. And, exactly. And he gets the famous, it has to be mentioned, revolutionary costume of the day. So, and little Edie is worried that he might be scandalized by her costume. Gosh. Yeah, that's early on. They really hit you with it up front. You get mother wanted me to come out in a kimono and we had an awful fight, and then that her entire description of her costume and how she describes her clothes as her costume. This is the right costume for the day.
Which again, I feel like, I mean, a lot of women were probably thinking a lot of women definitely were thinking that at the time and now still to a degree. And like stuff like that, putting that on camera. I know when Edie was showing this afterwards, in years afterwards, I know that Jackie O and the family were still a little scandalized because they talked pretty plainly about sex in this. And they were like, I wish you hadn't done that. Like, you get a very honest look at, a number of ways, but like just in aspect, they're just eating ice cream and talking about sex.
Yeah.
Like, isn't that that feels like such a refreshing modern idea of what women do, but like, no, women were doing it back then. It just wasn't on camera.
No, but they were going to do what they were going to do. It just so happened that there were cameras there.
And then, we've talked about how David and Al have been on camera, and I just want to highlight that at the end. A very conscious and interesting choice camera shot when Edie and Edie are having an argument, one of their more full-blown arguments near the end of it. And David and Elle, they're not saying anything. They're not going to get involved. But they turn the camera to a mirror, and it's just them standing there like, yep, we're here. Like, we're watching this at the same time you are. This is happening. That's a really fascinating direction there.
Yeah. No, it's as you were saying it, I could like see the scene playing in my head. And that is such a conscious choice to exactly like what you're saying, to say like, this is going on in full view of us, just letting you know.
I have no idea what other documentaries at the time were doing that. To me, that feels like The Office. That is Jim looking at the camera.
Yes. Yes. It 100% is. And you kind of giggle a little bit because like it is somewhat absurd. But so real. It's such a real, honest moment. Like, how many times have we been in the room when family or friends are arguing and you wish you could be invisible? We're going to start wrapping up. And I think this was an amazing, amazing discussion. Thank you so much for joining me for this today. I loved talking about this movie with you.
Thank you for inviting me. I know when you brought up the idea months and months ago, however long ago, I remember you mentioned it and I was like, okay, I mean, that was a film we mentioned on the podcast. Sure, okay. But like watching it again and doing all the research and making the notes for it and having this conversation, yeah, it was such a great time. Yeah, as I say, I watched Grey Gardens years and years ago. I don't know if I would have watched it again if not for this, but I'm so glad I did because I have a really enriched perspective on this and an opinion on this, and I definitely do recognize just how great it is. I'm really happy you invited me on here to do this.
Yay. I'd love to have you start looking at movies that were released in years ending in 6, because I'd love to have you back as we continue into 2026. This was just a blast. Would you like to let the audience know where they can find you if they'd like to continue the conversation?
Great. On socials, you can find me at Absolute Travis T. I'm on a few of them, Instagram, Twitter, the like. It's funny that you mention anniversaries, mm-hmm. Because I do a lot of that over at framerated.co.uk. I do written pieces on mostly retrospectives, looking at old movies. I occasionally look at new movies on that site, as most writers on there do. If you want to hear me talk more about movies, you can find me on At The Movies in the Noughties, which Violet has been on. Violet is welcome to come on again. We talk about not strictly anniversary movies there, but just any movies from the 2000s. Mostly big, important films, but then I throw some random 2000s nonsense in there as well. And if you really love hearing my voice talking about anything movie related, then check out Chucky Vision, where we have talked about the Chucky movies, the TV show, which was what the podcast was about. But with that ending, we now talk about any old killer doll movies and any old Chucky related content. In 2026, we are going to be doing Child's Play Minute. So that is 89 episodes dedicated to each and every minute of Child's Play.
Wow.
And we get into some right random shite on those episodes.
Oh, that sounds like a blast. Oh, man. Yep. Shout out to Mark, your co-host.
Mm-hmm.
You guys are so funny. Oh, that sounds great. I'll definitely be tuning into that. Can't wait. Oh, my goodness. Well, as usual, you can find me on my Linktree. It's linktr.ee/violet.h.310. And on there, you will see the links for Movieversaries episodes, links for the Disney podcast I co-host with Jeff Owen, Three Circles, and also every other podcast like yours, which is kind enough to have me come on and blather my nonsense. And I would like to thank you once again so much, Devin Elson, for joining me today, and to everyone who has tuned in. We very much hope you've enjoyed the show. If you have, please subscribe to Movieversaries and give us a rating and a review wherever you can. While you're here, you should check out the show notes. You'll find links to all of our things that we are doing, as well as a link to the Discord where you can come and have a chat with us. Thanks again for your company, and see you for the next installment of Movieversaries.
Bye.